Listening to CGSF 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Thank God for the ceasefire, the end of bloodshed and killing. I'm not the only one happy. All the Gaza Strip is happy. All the Arab people. All the world is happy with the ceasefire and the end of bloodshed. Thank you and all the love to those who stood with us.
Celebrations break out in Gaza and Israel after President Trump announced Israel and Hamas have agreed on the first phase of a hostage ceasefire deal. But questions remain over what happens next. We'll go to Gaza and Israel for response. Then to Nelson Mandela's grandson, Mandla Mandela, back in South Africa, one of hundreds of global smooth flotilla activists abducted by Israel on the high seas.
We were kidnapped on international waters. Palestinians are attacked, maimed, and killed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump says Israel and Hamas have agreed to the first phase of a Gaza ceasefire deal. Trump announced the breakthrough in a post to his social media site Truth Social Wednesday, writing, quote, "All the hostages will be released very soon, and Israel withdraws their troops to an agreed-upon line," unquote. Details of the first phase have not yet been officially released. The Israeli government's meeting this afternoon to formally vote on the ceasefire deal. Far-right ministers, including Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, say they will not vote in favor of the plan, but have withdrawn threats to withdraw from Netanyahu's coalition government, bringing it down. If Israel's Security Cabinet approves the ceasefire, as expected, it will go into effect immediately. In the meantime, Israel's continuing its attacks on Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli strikes over the past 24 hours have killed 10 people, including two people seeking food, while injuring nearly 50 others. Despite the continuing assault, Palestinians across Gaza erupted in celebrations overnight as news of a ceasefire deal spread by word of mouth due to an internet and communications blackout.
I don't have a spoon nor a fork in my house. It is just some stones. Others lost their families. Some lost everything they own. And some had their families wiped out from the civil registry, and they stayed alone. Others lost their legs and limbs. Some lost everything, and some went missing as well. We ask God for safety, and may safety, security, goodness, and peace prevail.
After headlines, we'll go to Gaza and Israel for the latest. Spain's parliament has approved a formal arms embargo in Israel, permanently banning the sale of weapons and military equipment. Meanwhile, protesters across the Netherlands have held sit-in protests at 20 train stations in several cities, demanding the Dutch government end its support for Israel. This comes after an estimated quarter of a million demonstrators joined a red line protest last weekend against Israel's assault on Gaza, the largest anti-war protest in the Netherlands since the anti-nuclear rallies of the 1980s. In the United States, Senate Republicans Wednesday blocked a bipartisan resolution that would have limited President Trump's authority to launch military strikes against alleged drug traffickers in the Caribbean. The resolution was led by Democratic Senators Adam Schiff and Tim Kaine, with backing from Republican Senator Rand Paul. This is Senator Kaine.
Letting a single individual take us to war based on a secret list that he won't even reveal to the public or to Congress sets such a dangerous precedent. And if my colleagues, as they've stated, believe we should be at war in the Caribbean or at war with nations in the Americas over the narco traffickers. They've had the ability the entire time to bring a resolution before us and have that debate in front of the American public.
This comes as 60 organizations, including Oxfam America and Human Rights First, sent a letter to Congress Wednesday condemning the recent U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean, writing, quote, "We fear, barring decisive action by members of Congress, there will be more strikes, more extrajudicial killings, and potentially a full-blown limitless war with one or more countries in the region with likely devastating humanitarian and geopolitical consequences," unquote. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, claimed his forces halted a false flag operation to bomb the U.S. embassy in Caracas. In Washington, D.C., the U.S. government shutdown has entered its ninth day. The Senate failed to pass two funding bills that would have ended the shutdown. The Democrats' bill included more than $1 trillion in health care funding, which include Affordable Care Act subsidies. Congressional Democrats have introduced another bill that would pay child care fees for federal workers during the shutdown. On Wednesday, the IRS announced it'll furlough about 34,000 workers, nearly half its workforce, because of the shutdown. Meanwhile, Democratic Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego confronted House Speaker Mike Johnson for failing to swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva.
As soon as you guys vote to open the government,
you don't want to be on that same district.
How much?
It's totally absurd. You guys are experts in red herrings and distraction. There's nothing to do with Epstein.
To see our interview with Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, go to democracynow.org. The Pentagon's Northern Command says 500 National Guard soldiers from Illinois and Texas have arrived in the Chicago region, despite opposition from local officials who've sued to stop the deployment. Their arrival came as President Trump wrote on his social media site that Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, quote, should be in jail for failing to protect ICE officers, unquote. On Wednesday, Governor Pritzker rejected Trump's threat, saying, "Come and get me." He said Trump had deployed the troops without any advance notice.
I've said over and over again, the federal government has not communicated with our state in any way whatsoever about what their troop movements are going to be. I can't believe I have to say troop movements in a city in the United States, but that is what we're talking about.
Illinois Governor Pritzker also said Wednesday he believes Trump's normalizing the use of the military ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, when Pritzker believes Trump may have soldiers stationed outside polling places to, quote, assume control of the ballot boxes and count the votes himself, unquote. Meanwhile, Pastor is one of several plaintiffs suing the Trump administration after he was shot directly in the head by a pepper ball fired by ICE agents on a roof during protests at the Broadview ICE jail just outside Chicago. Video of the assault shows Pastor David Black of First Presbyterian Church of Chicago immediately falling to the ground. Just before the attack, he was praying. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the woman who was shot multiple times by U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents in Chicago says she did not ram her car into the agents, as they claimed, and that her gun was stored in her purse. Marimar Martinez was arrested with assaulting a federal officer after DHS claimed the agent fired their weapon in self-defense. President Trump led a roundtable on Antifa Wednesday, hosting far-right activists posing as independent journalists. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem compared Antifa to MS-13, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Islamic State. This follows President Trump's executive order last month designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. This is Trump Wednesday claiming without evidence that Antifa is paid and funded.
The epidemic of left-wing violence and Antifa-inspired terror has been escalating for nearly a decade. At universities, Antifa has organized riotous mobs to attack campus speakers. I see it all the time. And these are agitators, anarchists, and they're paid. We're going to be very threatening to them, far more threatening to them than they ever were with us. And that includes the people that fund them.
Rutgers University history professor Mark Bray says his family's moving from New Jersey to Spain after receiving death threats, including at their home address. Bray was teaching courses on anti-fascism and terrorism at Rutgers. He's the author of the 2017 book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. His planned flight from the U.S. comes after the Rutgers chapter of the campus conservative group, Turning Point USA, circulated a petition labeling him Dr. Antifa and calling for him to be fired. In an interview with Newsweek, Bray said, quote, "This is reflective of the broader trend in the country. The Trump administration, I believe, is moving the country in a markedly authoritarian direction, and that takes a number of forms. But one of those forms is an attack on academic freedom and higher education," unquote. Former FBI Director James Comey appeared in federal court in Virginia Wednesday, where he pleaded not guilty to charges he lied to Congress. The trial is set to begin January 5th. Federal prosecutors expect it to last 2 to 3 days. Comey's lawyer, Patrick Fitzgerald, said he would ask the judge to dismiss the case, claiming, quote, "selective retaliatory prosecution at the direction of President Trump to silence Comey," unquote. In immigration news, the Washington Post reports nearly a quarter of the FBI's roughly 13,000 agents are currently assigned to immigration enforcement, with the number climbing to upward of 40% in the largest FBI field offices. Data show agents have been pulled from investigations into cybercrimes, drug trafficking, terrorism, counterintelligence, and more. Meanwhile, Apple's quietly removed the citizen reporting app De-Icer from its App Store. The app is used by activists and immigrant communities to track ICE activity. Migrant Insider reports the decision effectively treats federal immigration agents as a protected class, a novel interpretation of Apple's hate speech policy that shields one of the most powerful arms of the federal government from public scrutiny. In Tennessee, Democratic State Assembly member Justin Pearson announced Wednesday he'll launch a primary challenge against Democratic Representative Steve Cohen of Memphis. Pearson was a member of the Tennessee Three who were expelled by Republicans from the Tennessee State Assembly after participating in a gun control protest on the State House floor.
We've got a gun violence epidemic that is quite literally taking the lives of our loved ones away.
Yes.
The number one killer of children in our communities is not cancer. It is not car accidents. It's bullets. And if people want to do something about crime, pass some gun safety laws.
Yes.
If people want to do something about crime, pass violence intervention programs and money and resources for our beloved and beautiful community. Don't occupy us. Eradicate poverty.
Yes.
The 2025 Nobel Prize in Literature has been awarded to the Hungarian novelist László Krasznahorkai. The Nobel Committee called him, quote, "a great epic writer in the Central European tradition that extends through Kafka to Thomas Bernhardt and is characterized by absurdism and grotesque excess," unquote. Meanwhile, this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to a trio of researchers, including Omar Yaghi, a Jordanian-American chemist at the University of California, Berkeley, for pioneering work on porous molecular structures that can be used to trap greenhouse gases and other pollutants. The Palestinian scientist Yaghi was born in Amman to Palestinian refugee parents who fled their homes in Gaza in 1948. When those establishing the State of Israel violently expelled over 700,000 Palestinians. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Celebrations broke out in Gaza and Israel after President Trump announced Israel and Hamas have agreed on the first phase of a hostage ceasefire deal. President Trump said the remaining Israeli hostages held in Gaza would likely be released on Monday. Israel has also agreed to release Palestinians held captive in Israeli prisons, but a final list of prisoners has not been released. During the first phase of the deal, Israel will withdraw forces from parts of Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the besieged strip. A ceasefire is expected to begin after Israel formally approves the deal later today, but Israel is still carrying out attacks in Gaza, killing at least 10 Palestinians over the last day. The Palestinian journalist Motassem Dalul just revealed Israeli forces have killed his third son. Two other sons were killed last year.
There are many questions over what will happen after Hamas releases the remaining hostages. Amnesty International said the ceasefire deal must be a pathway to what it called Israel's unlawful occupation, apartheid, and genocide. In the city of Khan Yunis, residents responded to the ceasefire deal.
I don't have a spoon nor a fork in my house. It is just some stones. Others lost their families. Some lost everything they own. And some had their families wiped out from the civil registry, and they stayed alone. Others lost their legs and limbs. Some lost everything, and some went missing as well. We ask God for safety, and may safety, security, goodness, and peace prevail.
In Israel, hostage families welcome the news of a deal. This is Gil Dickman. His cousin, Carmel Gat, was taken hostage on October 7th and killed in captivity.
I couldn't be happier. The fact that finally hostages are coming back, that the deal was signed, that the war is over. It's a happy day. It's a holiday here. That's what we wanted for such a long time. Carmel, my cousin, was murdered in captivity. She's not going to come back. It's too late for her, but it's not too late. For 48 hostages are going to come back. 20 of them are going to come back alive. And this is such a happy moment for us, the families of the hostages. Such a happy moment for all Israelis and for all the Middle East.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer praised the deal while on a trip to India.
I'm grateful for the tireless diplomatic efforts of Egypt, Qatar, Turkey, United States, and many others in securing this crucial first step. This agreement must now be implemented in full, without delay, and be accompanied by the immediate lifting of all restrictions on life-saving humanitarian aid to Gaza. The UK will support these crucial immediate steps and the next stages of the talks to ensure the full implementation of the peace plan.
We go now to Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, where we're joined by Ead Amawi, a representative of the Gaza Relief Committee. Ead, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain, describe to us the reaction on the ground to this ceasefire deal?
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for Democracy Now! For your interesting. Now it's a mixed feelings. Happiness, worries, and hopes, and a lot of celebration here, and also a lot of sadness. It's a mix because the previous time we suffered from genocide, from uprooting us, trying to expulsion us from our homes, from our land, from our city, Gaza. Up to this moment, we're still waiting the exact appointment for complete implementations. So we're still waiting until this moment. The people hearing some tank shelters and guns in the coastal area road, and they prevent the people from returning to the Gaza City. We have some casualties now at this time. So we hope the ceasefire implementation will come speedily without any delay.
So, Ead, you've laid out a number of steps that you think should be the priority in terms of aid getting into Gaza and the assistance that's needed in Gaza most urgently. Could you just lay out those things?
Yeah. Firstly, entering the numbers of trucks that determined before, maybe 400 up to 600, without restrictions, especially for the nutritious food. And the second, the huge machinery and cairns and bulldozers that can leveling the lands and removing the rebels to set up new camps to meet our needs and our displacement people. They haven't shelters, have tents. So this is the two main issues that we need urgently in Gaza Strip. And repairing water desalination and repairing sewage networks urgently to prevent pollutions and bad environment here that cause diseases and spread of infectious disease also in Gaza.
You've also called for population distribution. If you could explain why.
Yeah. We now live 1.5 million in the shrinked area, especially in the western part, in the south part of Deir al-Balah, and in Al-Mawasi region. It's just 17 square kilometers. You can imagine when we live in this circumstances, we will not have a normal life, and it's very bad conditions here. So when we talk about redistribution peoples and all of the Gaza Strip, it will be better, and we can provide people with their needs, with their aids, and with their shelters. Everything will be okay.
Can you explain, although we reported that a ceasefire deal has been reached, or President Trump did, there have been heavy airstrikes and artillery shelling in Gaza City and Khan Yunis. Israeli quadcopters also reported to have dropped bombs on civilians in Gaza City. About 9 people or 10 were killed in attacks in the last hours. Meanwhile, Israeli tanks blocking al-Rashid road to prevent displaced Palestinians from returning to their homes in northern Gaza. When do you see these attacks stopping? Also, people killed again trying to get food.
Okay, that's great. You can distinguish between two things here in our local, with our local peoples. The annunciation without determining exact hour, it's also the Israeli habits in all of the ceasefire agreements. So they grant themselves more time to punish our people, to increase the suffering. So when we talk about the agreement as official agreement, we need to determine the exact hour to prevent the continuity of this suffering immediately.
Iyad Amawi, thank you for being with us. I want to ask, were you in the street celebrating as you heard this news?
We hope that, and we will celebrate even though what's still happening here and what we faced before. But it's our life. We resume it, inshallah.
Iyad Amawi is a representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, coordinator for local NGOs, speaking to us to Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Coming up, we continue to look at the ceasefire hostage deal. We will go to Israel, and we will go to Copenhagen, and we will go to Montreal to get response.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome one day. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall.
Roger Waters performing We Shall Overcome, accompanied by a young Alexander Rowatin on cello in the Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
To talk more about Hamas and Israel agreeing to the first phase of a ceasefire hostage deal, we're joined now by three guests. Moin Rabbani, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies. His latest piece is headlined, Key Points and Prospects of the Israeli-Palestinian Agreement. And Ori Goldberg is Israeli political analyst and scholar in Tel Aviv. He's written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East.
But first, we go to Copenhagen, where we're joined by Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. His latest piece for 972 magazine is headlined, 2 years after October 7th, Palestine has become a graveyard of failed strategies. We, though, are going to go first to Muin Rabbani as we fix some connections. Muin, can you respond to this hostage ceasefire deal? What do we know? What has been laid out? What hasn't?
Well, as you may recall, the Trump-Netanyahu proposal announced at the White House last week dealt with three sets of issues. The immediate ones, meaning an exchange of captives, Israeli withdrawal, humanitarian aid, and cessation of hostilities. Then post-war governance, basically Project Blair, putting him in charge as the viceroy of the Gaza Strip. And thirdly, but only very tangentially, political issues, the crisis that produced this crisis, if you will. The agreement that was signed yesterday in Egypt deals exclusively with the first set of issues. So Israel and the Palestinians have agreed on an exchange of captives. We don't yet know the details of that in terms of which Palestinians will be released from Israel's prison system and according to what schedule. There is a cessation of hostilities, and there's a statement earlier today that Qatar and the United States have guaranteed that hostilities will not resume. I think those are relatively worthless commitments because with Trump, you can't trust a word he says about anything. And Qatar is, of course, not in a position to compel this. And in terms of the Israeli withdrawal, there is an agreed line of withdrawal, but that also hasn't been clarified publicly. And some of these issues may, in fact, still be under discussion. The additional issues, post-war governance and the political issues, were entirely ignored. And this is seen as an achievement by Hamas, which very much wanted an agreement on the first set of issues, but was essentially being asked to commit political suicide and to accept national capitulation on behalf of the Palestinians with the other aspects. One point, I think we're now at a fork in the road. A continuation of this process, while it's very welcome, of course, that the genocide may be coming to an end and is at least now paused, this is a renewed Oslo process with an even lower political ceiling. And the key issue now is there is massive global momentum for a different paradigm in which Palestinian rights, in which Israeli accountability for its actions replaces these meaningless, endless negotiations about nothing that result in nothing. And I think that momentum also helps explain why we have this agreement finally, one that the Biden administration systematically refused to implement, but that Trump was able to force Israel to accept with a single phone call. And maintaining and intensifying that momentum is absolutely essential to ensure that the genocide does not resume in full force, that ethnic cleansing remains off the agenda, and that the real political issues can finally be addressed in line with international law and Palestinian rights.
So we have Mohammad Shehada now. So, Mohammad, if you could respond to this deal and explain what you think made it possible now. What role did the Gulf states play? You were just in Istanbul. What role did Turkey play?
Well, the main thing that explains it is that tomorrow is the day where the Nobel Prize Committee will announce the Nobel Peace Prize winner. So that's the main thing that comes to mind. Otherwise, the second thing is Qatar, after Israel bombed Doha so viciously, Qatar has been demanding a price from the Trump administration. And Trump's security reassurances that he gave in this executive order are practically worth nothing. So you saw basically Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, and other Arab and Muslim countries meeting with Trump on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly and trying to create some momentum towards ending the genocide in Gaza. Trump wanted it to end it on Israel's own terms, which were catastrophic. There was an earlier draft of the deal that was somewhat reasonable. Then Netanyahu spent 6 hours with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff and manipulated it out of any meaning or substance and added to it this colonial aspect of the Trump-Blair border peace. But what you had is Hamas being advised by Qatar, Turkey, and Egypt to deliver a response very carefully that said, yes, we agree to the withdrawal of the Israelis from Gaza. We agree to the release of Israeli captives and release of Palestinian captives and hostages. And yes, we agree to the end of the war. But the rest of Trump's idea will be delayed until a later point because we do not have the mandate to negotiate all of all those things. It's a Palestinian decision. And it was a clever way of sort of like saying yes to the parts that are actually doable and the parts that were so incredibly fantastical to leave them at a later point that hopefully will never come.